Podcast today's show at rte.ie/todaywithseanaroorke.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. In July of this year, Andy Coulson, former editor of Rupert Murdoch's News of the World and David Cameron's director of communications, was sentenced to 18 months in jail for his part in one of the greatest scandals of our time. His undoing began back in 2009 when Nick Davies, who's a freelance journalist with The Guardian newspaper, first broke the story about the use of widespread phone hacking at the paper. Its tentacles stretched all the way to the top echelons of police and politics in the UK. Well, Nick Davies has now written a book about his investigation. It's called Hack Attack: How the Truth Caught Up with Rupert Murdoch. And Nick joins me this morning from London. You're very welcome to the programme, Nick.
Hi, good to be here.
For you, what has this scandal really been all about? What is at its heart?
Okay, so it isn't really about Andy Coulson or other journalists behaving badly. That's just the starting point. Really, it's all about power and the abuse of power. So if you start with the crime in the News of the World, as soon as you start looking at that, you say, well, hang on a moment. This has been going on for years, brazenly so. Where was the press regulator? And then more important than that, where were the police? And then as you look into that, you see how historically, over and over again, those organisations failed to take on the News of the World and other newspapers who were also committing crime because they were too powerful. They were scared of them. And then if you push it a level further, you start to get into government, which I've done a lot about in this book. You go down the corridors of power and you see this government that is allegedly going to do what its voters want it to do, in fact doing what a powerful media mogul wants it to do. And so that may affect really big decisions like whether or not to invade Iraq, whether or not Britain joins the euro, but down to small things as well. Like I discovered that when Rebecca Brooks, or Rebecca Wade as she then was, first started going out with Charlie Brooks, whom she married, she had a word with Gordon Brown about something that Charlie wanted done. He's a racehorse trainer, and he doesn't like the special horse racing levy, the tax on that industry. So Rebecca says to the Prime Minister, what about it? You know, do you think you might cancel that tax? And Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, commissioned officials to study that, to see whether it could be done. Not because the voters want it done, we haven't asked for that at all, but because Murdoch's editor's boyfriend would like it done. And in the end of the day, it wasn't done. But you see the power there. It goes across the spectrum. So that's why the story is worth covering.
Absolutely. And I suppose for many people, you can understand to an extent why politicians might be fearful of someone like Rupert Murdoch when he is so powerful, controls so much of the world's media. Why were the police scared of him?
First of all, you used the right word there, fearful. And what does that fear consist of? It's really two things. For the individual minister or the government minister or the individual police chief, there is the horrible possibility that they might investigate your private life and humiliate you by exposing something to do with your personal life or your sex habits or something like that. So there's a real personal fear there. And then beyond that, these are newspapers who can destabilize an organization, whether it's a government or a political party or a police service, simply by running aggressive stories on their front page day after day, changing the agenda of that organization's business. Every problem becomes a crisis. Every internal argument becomes a massive split or dispute. So that there is fear in all of these organizations in power. I've said it's a weird thing, actually, that among ordinary people, I don't think anybody's scared of Rupert Murdoch at all. I think they hold him in some contempt because he's so greedy and wealthy. But among the most powerful, there is a real fear of him. And that applies to the police as well as to government.
And reading some of the chapters in your book, Nick, they had secrets on everyone.
Yeah, I mean, the scale of their gathering of secrets is pretty scary. If you think at the beginning, so far as the voicemail hacking is concerned, we were told there were only 8 victims. This was what the police were saying and what Murdoch's company was saying. And now, having had a decent police inquiry, we discover there weren't 8 victims of voicemail hacking. There were 5,500. That gives you a glimpse of the scale on which they're doing this. And yeah, it's a very powerful thing if you start gathering people's secrets about people's personal lives. And you don't have to use them. I mean, if people just know that you're capable of doing that, it means that they kind of tiptoe around you and try to please you. I've said in the book, it's a bit like the power of the playground bully. If the bully beats up one or two kids, all the other children in the playground start working very hard to please him.
Let's go back to the start, Nick. And as you say, you know, initially it was Clive Goodman, the royal editor with The Sun, private investigator Glenn Mulcair, who were jailed for hacking the voicemails of three royals.
Yeah.
How did you figure out that there was a lot more to it than just that?
Actually, it was pathetically easy. I was doing a radio interview for BBC in London, where this was 6.5 years ago. I just published a book about news organisations and how they frequently fail to tell the truth. And in that book, I'd done a little bit about private investigators working for Fleet Street doing dodgy things. And in the studio during this radio interview that I was doing was a senior guy from the News of the World who attacked me verbally and said that I was completely wrong about private investigators doing illegal things for newspapers. Well, he, the News of the World guy, was so far wide of the mark that he provoked somebody I'd never heard of who was listening to the radio program into getting in touch with me. And he became a primary source and a guide through the story. And what that meant was that early on, through that source, I understood the scale on which the News of the World had been breaking the law. I understood that it had big implications for the press regulator and for the police and for the Conservative Party who'd hired Andy Coulson, who'd been editor. But it's not enough to know the truth when you're coming up against an aggressive and dishonest organisation, as Murdoch's company undoubtedly was at that time. You have to be able to prove every damn step of the way. And that's what became really difficult, was to drag the proof out so that their denial would be pushed back.
And how big a battle was that? You and your relatively small team up against this global corporation.
Yeah. So it did feel like a very steep hill to climb. There were times when it was very stressful. So it's no fun for me sitting at my desk to see Murdoch's newspapers pouring scorn on The Guardian, accusing me of deliberately misleading the British people. I may know that I'm not misleading the British people, but the British people don't know that because these newspapers are telling them. And then beyond that, there was some quite dirty stuff went on. So some of the lawyers and members of Parliament who joined in this attempt to expose the truth later discovered that the News of the World had hired a private investigator to follow them, to try to dig out embarrassing details about their personal life or their sex lives in order to punish them, to put them off the scent, to get them to back off. And that's really dirty play. As far as I know, that didn't happen to me, but it certainly happened to some of the other people who were involved in this.
What was your impression of the court case back in July, or before that? Obviously, it was going on for some time. What emerged and how it ended up? Because a lot of people say, you know, Rupert Murdoch's money was evident everywhere in that courtroom.
That is definitely true. So I've been covering trials at the Old Bailey for about 35 years, and I've never seen anything like it in terms of a defence being so well funded. And I wrote about this in The Guardian actually afterwards, that it was like a microcosm of the great shift in power that's happened in the Western world over the last 20 or 30 years, away from the state, which is now so poorly funded because of tax cuts, towards the big corporations. So in that courtroom at the Old Bailey, you had the Crown Prosecution Service, which was like a kind of horse and cart up against the Murdoch funded defence, which was like this Rolls Royce. And it did make a difference. I wouldn't want to say that it made such a difference that the verdicts were wrong. That there was a really good police inquiry. That was a very good jury who sat there for 8 months, and they were remarkable the way they paid attention. A good straight judge who showed no fear or favour towards those defendants. And at the end of the trial, Rebecca Brooks was acquitted. And I wouldn't want to argue with the acquittal. I think she's entitled to take that away and to say that she's not been convicted. Andy Coulson, guilty. You know that five other people pleaded guilty at the beginning of the trial as well. And so what the trial did, in spite of the impact of Murdoch's money, was to prove the guilt of these key people in the News of the World and to expose the scale of the criminality in which they were engaged. There was a nice line from the prosecutor at the end who said, "The News of the World, up to the very highest level, was a criminal organisation."
You've praised the police investigation, but it took a very long time to get them interested. What was the turning point?
The turning point in all this was the story we did. I mean, we'd been writing about this for about 2 years when I did the story about Millie Dowler, the 13-year-old schoolgirl from Surrey who'd been abducted and murdered, that the News of the World had hacked into her voicemail. And that, I think it wouldn't have had such an impact if it hadn't been for the 2 years of preceding stories. But it finally kind of burst the balloon, because people said, well, it's one thing to hack, let's say, Hugh Grant or Sienna Miller, but hacking a child who's been abducted and murdered, whoa, you've crossed the line there. And it was interesting, actually, because up until that point, One of the problems had been that most other newspapers were refusing to cover the story. An awful lot of newspapers had been up to no good themselves with private investigators. The Millie Dowler story changed that. And once the other newspapers joined in, they started to produce amazing stuff. Like the Daily Telegraph, after the Millie Dowler story, disclosed that the News of the World had also hacked the voicemail of the families of people who had died in the terrorist bombings in London in July 2005. And again, you look at that and you go, whoa, you are so far over the line. What do you think you're doing? And that, I think, it changed the public mood. And after a long period of time in which many, many people in public life resented Rupert Murdoch, but nobody would speak out against him, there was then this change where nobody wanted to be seen as his friend anymore. And there was this sort of a sleeping army of hostility towards Rupert Murdoch, which suddenly came out in the public. Everybody changed sides. You remember there was that moment where, about a week after the Millie Dowler story, the House of Commons voted on whether or not the Murdochs should be allowed to take over B Sky B, the satellite broadcast organisation. And I'm pretty sure I'm right, it was unanimous. There's nobody was going to be seen on Murdoch's side anymore. Just back off. And it was an extraordinary moment. It's kind of like the kids taking over the classroom and all standing on the desks and shouting and the teacher's been expelled from the room. I have to say that mood didn't last terribly long, and I think an awful lot has returned to the bad
old
exactly, ways since
then. I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes, but did Murdoch know about the hacking, or was his approach, whatever means necessary, get the story?
I think certainly that is definitely true, that the Murdoch organisation is absolutely permeated with ruthlessness on the editorial side and on the commercial side, and there's a lot of that in the book. As to whether or not he knew about the voicemail hacking, the honest answer is I don't know. There was an interesting thing that emerged about 18 months ago where Murdoch went for a meeting with some reporters from The Sun in London. They were feeling very demoralised because quite a few of them had been arrested, and he was trying to cheer them up. What he didn't understand was that they were tape recording him, as they tend to do. And he said to them, he was talking about bribes to the police. He said, well, everybody knows that's always gone on in Fleet Street. And that was not really what a respectable proprietor would be saying. He ought to be saying, if it's gone on, it's certainly not going to go on in my organisation. Whether or not it's the same about the voicemail hacking, that he knew in principle that it was going on, I don't know.
But certainly Andy Coulson knew, and you have you write extensively about him and life working under him, for him, and the hypocrisy of it all. They set themselves up to be this moral watchdog, exposing drug abuse, sexual affairs, the whole lot, and they were doing it all themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it really is breathtakingly hypocritical, exactly as you've described it. If you talk to people who've worked for the News of the World, they describe lots and lots of sexual adventures going on in the office and quite a fair amount of cocaine abuse. I'm not saying everybody did it, but there was a fair amount of it being done quite often by the same people who were writing stories exposing public figures who dared to use cocaine or dared to have sex with somebody they weren't married to. It's massively hypocritical. And the other thing about that inside the News of the World chapter, which you've read, is about the bullying inside the office. It's a miserable, rotten place to work because of that logic that's being passed down from Rupert Murdoch. You get the story no matter what. And if you do well, you get praise. If you do badly, your life is made miserable. And what that means is that the bullied reporter goes out into the world and bullies the sources, or cheats the sources of information, and bullies and cheats the subjects of stories. The ruthlessness is passed down and down. So it was a horrible.
And the lengths they go to as well to stab each other in the back.
Yes, actually, it emerged during the trial that this was Clive Goodman, the royal editor, had quite a good source somewhere in the royal household, and an executive was jealous of him. So the executive privately hired a private investigator to follow Clive Goodman, his colleague, to see who he was meeting so that he could steal his source. Lots of backstabbing like that going on. And terrible enmity as well between the news department and the features department. It's like they were supposed to be competing with other Sunday newspapers, but actually the main competition was inside the office. It's just like rats fighting in a sack. You know, the whole thing is this horribly competitive, ruthless atmosphere.
Absolutely. And we've just seen in the last 24 hours two more journalists charged with phone hacking, and they worked in the features section. We've not talked too much about that. But going back to Rupert Murdoch and the politicians and his hold over the politicians, is his power undimmed, or has he been damaged as a result?
No, I would say probably undimmed. So, for example, within the Conservative Party, in London, it's recognised that if David Cameron loses the election and loses his position as leader, the two people most likely to take over are either Boris Johnson or Michael Gove, although he suffered a bit recently. When Rupert Murdoch's in town, who has dinner with him? Boris Johnson and Michael Gove, because they understand that Rupert is still the kingmaker. And you remember when, after the Millie Dowler story exploded, News Corp stopped holding this annual ritual of its summer party in London, which was like this occasion when it's almost like a sort of mafia godfather sitting there while all the politicians and everybody else from the power elite comes across and kisses his hand. Well, that's stopped, but it'll be really interesting to see whether it's revived again quite soon. And very interesting in the UK context to look at what happens in the run-up to our next general election, which is due in May next year. I suspect the Murdoch newspapers will be throwing their weight around as ever, trying to influence which government is elected. And I suspect that the politicians, as ever, will respond to that by trying to placate them and please them, because the power is still there. It's unchanged.
Is it possible to say, though, if national votes are affected to the extent that politicians believe they are by Rupert Murdoch or that by him himself?
It's an interesting question, because the people who research it actually find it very difficult to establish that any newspaper has ever actually swung the result of an election. But what matters more is the fear among politicians that that might be the case. And the fear is all. As long as politicians are afraid that a particular newspaper or newspaper organisation could swing the result of an election, they will respond off that fear and will try to placate it. And plus, as I've said, they're worried about being destabilised, they're worried about their private lives being exposed.
Is hacking ever justified, Nick, do you think?
Actually, I would think it could be. Let's say you're investigating a paedophile network and they've abducted a child and you know very well they're about to rape and possibly kill the child. The only way you can find out where that's happening is by hacking somebody's voicemail. I think everybody all the way up the criminal justice system would say that's okay. It is occasionally okay for any citizen to break the law in order to achieve a greater good. What I think is really important is that journalists don't have some license to become criminals. And particularly when that criminal activity is devoted to exposing people's sex lives and selling newspapers with tawdry, hypocritical stories, it's absolutely way beyond the boundaries.
Because the investigations editor of The Guardian, you know this very well, David Lay, admitted hacking himself to expose, he said, corruption and bribery and so on. He was never prosecuted. And
Sorry to interrupt you. That's exactly an example of what I'm saying. He was reporting corruption and bribes in the arms industry on a global scale. And he actually wrote about this voluntarily. And then that went all the way up the system. And the DPP said, well, that's OK. You're acting in the public interest. All law, when it's applied by prosecutors, has this public interest exemption, you know, from jumping a red traffic light because there's somebody giving birth in the back seat of your car, right the way up to something more serious.
The journalists have a very subjective view on what is in the public interest.
Yes, I think it's actually a very difficult thing to define. But if we're going back to the sort of the history of the scandal in Fleet Street, the sad reality is that because the police and the press regulators were backing off, the question of public interest and the law really didn't arise, because those newspapers were, in practice, beyond the law. The law wasn't interested. And I think it got so casual, some of this law-breaking, the paying of police officers as well as the hacking of phones, that the people involved actually forgot that it was against the law. You may remember that famous occasion in March 2003 when Rebecca Brooks was giving evidence to the Media Select Committee in the House of Commons and cheerily said, "We've paid the police in the past." I think they'd just lost their bearings.
Nick, how much damage would you say has been done to the media, but to newspapers in particular, as a result of what has happened?
Well, I think and hope that quite a lot of damage has been done to their criminal tendencies, which was a very bad thing. I would be happy to believe that a lot of damage has been done to their tendency to engage in aggressive falsehood and distortion, and their tendency to invade people's privacy in order to get stories to sell papers. I can't say that. I don't think very much has changed in the culture of those papers at all. Criminality, I would say, is down to zero. But horrible behaviour of various kinds and aggressive falsehood and distortion, pretty much unchanged.
Yeah. Do you still think voicemails are being hacked?
No, because that is criminal. I think that they would run a mile from that. There was a phase while we were covering the story, during the sort of key two-year period in the centre of it, where they got frightened of breaking the law. So what I found them doing was laundering criminal requests through regional news agencies. So the national newspaper would ring the news agency out in the countryside somewhere and said, can you contact the private investigator, ask them to do this, and then send us a memo. So they were using the regional news agency as a cutout. But I would say that now, since the crisis really broke in July 2011, even that has stopped.
Okay. Well, look, Nick, it's a fascinating read. And thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Okay. Your book is called Hack Attack, How the Truth Caught Up with Rupert Murdoch. It's out now. Nick Davies of The Guardian, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.